The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Day six of the Salem Trump trials. It all started with the judge hearing the prosecution's request for Trump to be held in contempt of court for allegedly violating his gag order 10 times, a.k.a. muzzling the leading presidential candidate in the thick of an election. D.A. Alvin Bragg's team must have gotten cold feet. Today they said they don't want to lock up Trump for speaking his mind. They just want to slap him with hefty fines. The judge hasn't made up his mind yet on what he's going to do. Then to the main show, ex-National Enquirer publisher David Pecker was back on the stand. The prosecution hoping to convince the jury that Trump tried to hide damaging stories ahead of the 2016 election. Pecker testified that he's been catching and killing stories for a long time, which is perfectly legal last time we checked.
Well, these are articles that were over the last day and a half. They're very good articles. Actually, the case is a sham and it shouldn't even be tried. It shouldn't have been submitted. And I don't even know if you're allowed to put them in. We have a gag order, which to me is totally unconstitutional. I'm not allowed to talk, but people are allowed to talk about me. So they can talk about me. They can say whatever they want. They can lie. But I'm not allowed to say anything. I just have to sit back and look at why a conflicted judge has ordered me to have a gag order. I don't think anybody's ever seen anything like this. I'd love to talk to you people. I'd love to say everything that's on my mind. But I'm restricted because I have a gag order. And I'm not sure that anybody's ever seen anything like this before.
Let's bring in Jonathan Turley now, George Washington University law professor and a Fox News contributor. Jonathan, you look at the court of public opinion on this, U.S. adults' view of the hush money case that we are watching play out in real time. And when asked how Americans see the former president Trump's behavior in this hush money case, 35% say they see it as illegal. Okay, but 31% say unethical but not illegal, and 14% say nothing wrong. So 45% of respondents say they see it unethical or nothing wrong, more than those who see it as illegal behavior. Your thoughts on this day?
Well, that's not unexpected. I think if you poll people and ask if Trump was responsible for the bubonic plague, you'd end up with the same 35%. I mean, we have these hard numbers on either end of the poll when it comes to Trump. They don't move no matter what the subject is. What is clear is in this case, Trump is right. I mean, this is an embarrassment. I mean, the fact that we are actually talking about this case being presented in a New York courtroom leaves me in utter disbelief. I mean, the arguments today did, in fact, capture all the problems here. You know, you had this misdemeanor under state law where that had run out. This is going back to related to the 2016 election. And they zapped it back into life by alleging that there was a campaign finance violation under the federal laws that doesn't exist. The Department of Justice doesn't view it this way. But on top of that, you've got these tough factual issues that were laid out well by the Trump team, saying someone else designated this as a legal expense. And he was actually paid far in excess of this because of this was a legal account. But also keep in mind, this is what Hillary Clinton's people did. You know, remember when they funded the Steele dossier, which they denied to reporters, they put it as a legal expense. And then they fought the eventual fine that they received from the federal government, saying, but it was a legal expense. But now you've got some of the same Democrats supporting this bizarre theory.
I guess the real crime is that Trump ran for president and beat Hillary. Prosecutors are arguing that it's a felony to quiet rumors about your personal life. A lot of presidents have made tabloid rumors disappear. Bill Clinton had a war room combating bimbo eruptions. Senator Ted Kennedy settled a case with Mary Jo's family after he left her for dead in the waters of Chappaquiddick. Alvin Bragg's arguing that Senator Kennedy should have used campaign funds and filed it with the FEC. That's nonsense. That was personal. Biden's former prosecutor told the jury today that Trump was trying to influence his own election. Trump's defense attorney told the jury trying to influence the election is called democracy. There's nothing wrong with the non-disclosure agreement. Can you believe the Democrats still can't get over the 2016 election? It's now a crime to beat Hillary. The squad admitted it's political, saying, you know, if Trump had just been impeached, we wouldn't have had to put him in jail.
Donald Trump's big crime, winning the 2016 election. My favorite phrase of the last 8 years is influencing an election, as if nothing or everything doesn't have some influence on an election. That's the point of a campaign. You want to influence voters. How dare Donald Trump try to influence a campaign? We heard it nonstop through all of the Russiagate hoax. Donald Trump won the 2016 election. He beat Obama's chosen successor, Hillary Clinton. He exposed the swamp, and they are reacting. They've been reacting now for close to a decade. Trump is exposing a corrupt system. And why wouldn't that corrupt system use every corrupt means possible to take him out of the way? That's what this Bragg case is all about, a corrupt system using corruption to take out the person exposing them. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston, still your host, as far as I know, for the next couple of days. I'm waiting for Mr. Stephen Fleury to call up, say he's taking the show over Zoom from some undisclosed location. I'm not actually sure where he is. I think it's a Mark Levin show where the opening says he's coming to you from a bunker in an undisclosed location. I'm not sure. Maybe he's in Manhattan reporting on the Alvin Bragg case. I don't know. Any comments for the show? Send those to td@thetrumpet.com. I apologize. I forgot that we also have a phone number if you want to call in to request any literature on today's show. 1-866-930-3024. All of our literature is free. Again, email comments, td@thetrumpet.com. Don't forget about the Dinesh D'Souza event, the live lecture on May 5th, and then his interview on this show with Mr. Stephen Fleury the following day on May 6th. Tickets available, $15 a piece at armstrongauditorium.org. Again, that's armstrongauditorium.org to get your tickets there. I love Jesse Waters calling it the Salem Trump trials. This is just another commentator at Fox called it the hocus pocus trial. I mean, they're just willing these crimes into existence. And who is orchestrating all of this? I mean, you know, if you've watched this show for any time, who's behind the earpiece in Joe Biden's ear? This is an article that was just published today. It's by Politico. It's titled "Inside the Off-the-Record Calls Held by Anti-Trump Legal Pundits." This article, I mean, it really stood out to me because you watch the media and you hear them, and we'll refer to them, we call it, they parrot each other. I think it was Ben Rhodes that called them the media blob. And they're like droids. They all repeat the same thing. And you're just like, well, who gives them those lines? I think a lot of times it's the New York Times. A lot of times it's the White House press secretary. This is what you're going to say for the day. But this Politico article talks about how these top Democrat legal analysts, they actually get together on a Zoom call every Friday and talk about how they're going to cover these events and give essentially analysis and input. I would say, it doesn't say this in the article, but I suppose men like Alvin Bragg and Letitia James get reports or listen in on these calls for guidance on how to handle their cases, because no reasonable person is going to do what they're doing. And certainly Alvin Bragg is not going to do that on his own. It's so crazy. It's so far out there. There's no way he would look at this case and think, I'm pegging my reputation to this. He's getting guidance and direction. This article from Politico says, as the Jan 6 committee was working on its bombshell investigation into the Capitol riot and Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the last election, committee staffers took some time out of their seemingly 24-hour jobs one day in 2022 to brief a group of lawyers and legal pundits on a Zoom call. The people on the call weren't affiliated with the investigation or the government. Everything you've got to put the scare quotes on. All of these people, they're in Washington, D.C. for a reason. They're not formally a part of the government. And that's what Politico wants you to believe that's the way it is. But they don't stay in Washington, D.C. for no reason. But they would have been, this is Politico, but they would have been familiar to anyone who watches cable news. They were some of the country's most well-known legal and political commentators, and they were there to get insights into the committee's work and learn about what to look for at the hearings. The group's gathering was not a one-time event, but in fact an installment in an exclusive weekly digital salon whose existence has not been previously reported for prominent legal analysts and progressive and conservative anti-Trump lawyers and pundits. Every Friday, they meet on Zoom to hash out the latest twists and turns in the Trump legal saga and intellectually stress test the arguments facing Trump on his journey through the American legal system. So all of these top lawyers, all of the guys, we play the clips from CNN and MSNBC, you'll recognize the names. They actually get together every Friday, and that's why they all say the same thing every week. Because they coordinate this. Politico says the meetings are off the record, a chance for the group's members, many of whom are formally or loosely affiliated with different media outlets, to grapple with a seemingly endless array of novel legal issues before they hit the airwaves or take to print or digital outlets to weigh in with their thoughts. About a dozen or more people join any given call, though no one takes attendance. Some group members wouldn't describe themselves with any partisan or ideological lean, but most are united by their dislike of Trump. And now listen to who is the one that hosts these calls. The group's host is Norman Eisen, a senior Obama administration official, longtime Trump critic, and CNN legal analyst who has been convening the group since 2022 as Trump's legal woes ramped up. Eisen was also a key member of the team of lawyers assembled by House Democrats to handle Trump's first impeachment. Now, all of these people, they're obviously ideologically aligned, but now they literally get together and they coordinate these things. We've played the Obama clip plenty of times. I would love to run things from the basement. If the puppet could just have an earpiece and I could run things, why are they all in D.C.? Why didn't Obama leave afterwards? It's why all of these people sound the same. It's why they're able to understand the minutiae of these random laws that average people could not grapple with. Alvin Bragg, frankly, doesn't even understand. And they listen in on these calls. And they take their orders probably from these sorts of phone calls. Politico says the regular attendees on Eisen's call include Bill Kristol, the longtime conservative commentator, Lawrence Tribe, the famed liberal constitutional law professor. He's the one that launched the effort to get Trump taken off the ballot in Colorado. You think he wasn't listening into these calls? Norm Eisen, you work for Obama. How does he want me to handle this case? George Conway, he's that the Lincoln Project. He's we play lots of clips from him. He's a real piece of work. Andrew Weissman, everybody knows Andrew Weissman. That was Mueller's pit bull. Jeffrey Toobin, he's on CNN. They're getting together and they're giving their input. How should we handle this? Now they're going to say it like, well, we're just talking about how to cover it. But these guys, they're part of the regime media. And don't think that guys like Alvin Bragg, Letitia James, or Fannie, they're not listening in or getting reports. How should we do this? How are we going to handle these things? Listen to Politico. Sometimes there's a special guest, like the January 6th committee staffers, who recalled briefing the group. Hey, get together with us. We just want to make sure everything you're saying lines up legally. We'll actually run this Jan 6 committee from the Zoom call. Coordinate with us. They phrase it as if, well, we just want to be brief so we know what to talk about. We know how you want us to say it. Perhaps it goes that way. Perhaps it goes the other way. Hey, make sure you talk about it this way. Make sure you phrase it this way. And then we'll be ready to support you minutes after you say it on CNN. Says one Friday last May, after E. Jean Carroll defeated Trump in the first of her two defamation cases to go on trial, her lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, joined as a guest to talk for roughly half an hour about her strategy for beating Trump in court. Now, is she going to brief them on her strategy, or is she going to get briefed on their strategy? I mean, this is Donald Trump had to pay $80 million because he essentially said he denied an accusation leveled against him. I mean, he said it in that opening clip. I'm not allowed to say anything. I just have to sit back and look at why a conflicted judge has ordered me to have a gag order. E. Jean Carroll can accuse him of rape 25, 30 years ago. Can't say when it happened. Can't even say where it happened. No witnesses. But if Donald Trump decides to say, that's not true, defamation, you're smearing her. Are you calling her a liar? Where are they getting that direction from? Is Roberta Kaplan really going to Norm Eisen and telling her, hey, I know what I'm doing? Or is it the other way around? Are the Obama lawyers telling these people, hey, this is what you are doing? Politico says, another time, J. Michael Luttig. We've played clips from Luttig. Remember, this case is unassailable. That was the extent of his deep political commentary on the Colorado ballot case. Couldn't tell you any of the details, just that it's unassailable. Over and over again. Another time, Luttig, a conservative legal scholar and former judge who helped lead the public campaign to disqualify Trump under the 14th Amendment, showed up to make his case before the panel of former Obama officials, the legal scholars. They coordinate their lawfare with approval and input from these Obama officials. And then Politico, they try to excuse these calls. Well, it's nothing out of the usual. And they've got four or five paragraphs in this article. I won't go through it, talking about how conservatives are going to use this to back up Trump's claims that the Democrats are using lawfare to get him. And they try to get ahead of that as if, well, expect these things and it's really a non-issue. No, you don't have to be intimidated by them saying it. These calls are unusual. It is a cabal, an organized coup to take out Donald Trump. Just because they get ahead of it and say conservatives are going to pounce on it doesn't mean that what they're doing isn't wrong. Politico says, there's also something very 2024 about this group. It's the perfect emblem of today's Trump media legal industrial complex. And then they go back, and I need to research this a bit more. They talk about this group called Journolist. This was in 2009, and it's essentially a similar setup to where all these journalists would get together in these chat rooms to brief each other, to get scoops from one another. And then they would all report it, and they'd all just make sure that they were covering things exactly the same way. A lot of that was because they couldn't put in the work to fact check themselves, so they all want to make sure they say exactly the same thing so they don't have to get corrected by another reporter. It is like Ben Rhodes said. I mean, Ben Rhodes understood the media complex. He called them the blob. He said, they're a bunch of 20-year-olds. We could tell them anything. And it's an official statement. And these official statements from the White House are what the fact checks are based on. Well, that's wrong, because the official White House position is this. Well, the White House can say whatever they want. Ben Rhodes understood it, understood that they're just the blob, that they're the regime propaganda. The author of this Politico piece says, indeed, as I was reporting this story, I learned that some members of the group were understandably anxious about its publication. Trump has claimed that there is a legal conspiracy against him, and there is a risk that news of a group such as this could give Trump and his allies an attractive target. I'll say, They say it all the time. Remember the Time magazine piece fortifying the 2020 election? Remember the Zoom calls back then? This isn't like they just, Norm Eisen came up with this idea in 2022. Remember the Time magazine piece? We were all anxiously on that Zoom call on November 3rd. It looked like Trump was going to win and we didn't know what to do. And everybody had to convene and we had to get guidance from them because we had all of the rioters on call. They said that. The rioters were on call and we were ready to dispatch them. Their militia. Hold off. Hold off. We will stop the counting in Fulton. We will stop the counting in Allegheny County. Don't release the brown shirts yet. We've got something else that we can do. Just wait. That was the Democrat strategy on these Zoom calls. All coordinating together. All working together. They're community organizers. They're very organized. And when you read about a phone or a Zoom conference like this, it's not they're just working to set the narrative. This is setting the game plan. I mean, they talk all the time about, well, Donald Trump, in his speech, there's dog whistles. And people know what to do when he says certain things. The Republican Party is not that organized. They are not that coordinated or organized. I mean, you read about it all the time. Donald Trump is not getting up there and whispering to some secret group that's set up throughout the nation to just snap into action. But when the media say that about Donald Trump, they're admitting that what they do, what that's actually what they're doing. When Barack Obama gets up and gives that Stanford address, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, that is a dog whistle. Everybody knows dear leader's speaking, and he's setting the narrative. He's setting the game plan. He's setting the agenda. Pay close attention, because what he says there is what we're going to do. And that's just what he says publicly. Politico, you probably know some of the other regular participants on the call, which draws in some of the most recognizable names in the anti-Trump cinematic universe. U.S. Attorney, these are from, they currently include Obama-era U.S. attorneys Harry Littman, Barbara McQuaid, Joyce White Vance. These are Obama lawyers in these calls. Littman now works for the Los Angeles Times, McQuaid, MSNBC, Jennifer Rubin, she shows up a lot, the token conservative for the Washington Post, who's, I love that, the conservative columnist, Jennifer Rubin, who's far left of even the left. You could just call yourself whatever you want, I guess. Mary McCord, another one. Karen, I don't know some of these names. Anyway, this is a quote from America Under Attack, and this is Mr. Fleury writing about the election, says, and this is 2022, and it's all because of the radical left's unrestrained assault on America's democratic institutions and traditions, including the Constitution and the rule of law. Thousands of people and institutions were directly or indirectly involved. Virtually all of America's top media organizations and personalities were complicit, as well as the powerful tech companies and many of the nation's top politicians, talking about stealing that election. But this vast network of lies, corruption, and lawlessness all points back to one man, Barack Obama. He writes, as we will see, this epic scandal would not have taken place if not for Obama's leadership of the Democratic Party and the radical left. And there is proof that he not only was aware of the plot to pervert the 2020 election, but was directly or indirectly leading those pulling the strings. And that book talks about the media being complicit. They are the regime media. It's not by accident that they all sound the same. It's not by accident that they sound like droids. They're taking orders, not driven by their pursuit of the truth, not driven by their pursuit to inform you, the American citizen, driven by their pursuit to please the dear leader, to do what the dear leader says, because if they don't, they'll lose their jobs. They'll be punished. They'll be canceled. Speaking about the regime media, I wanted to follow up a little bit about the Hamas protests, the Ivy League Intifada that we talked about on Monday. There are video clips of protesters outside of Chuck Schumer's house. Chuck Schumer, he's Jewish. Those protesters were arrested immediately. If they were outside of Justice Kavanaugh's house and they were attempting to assassinate him, they would be permitted, of course, to continue their peaceful protest. But this story, again, is about the radical left and the radical left as it that is behind these terror organizations that coordinate with far-left donor groups and social media to promote their cause. Before we get into that story from the Wall Street Journal, listen to Joy Reid come to the defense of the mostly peaceful Hamas protesters over the weekend. This is clip 12.
The students who were arrested were peaceful and did not resist. They erected dozens of tents on a campus lawn last week and refused to leave until Columbia met their demands, including divesting from companies with ties to Israel. Students on campuses across this country have created encampments in solidarity with those arrested, including at MIT, Yale, New York University, and the New School. At the crux of these on-campus tensions are allegations of anti-Semitism hurled against Jewish students, or accusations that Columbia's leadership has not done enough to keep students safe. A dueling narrative has emerged, with student protesters saying the anti-Semitism is not coming from Columbia students.
Maybe tomorrow, you could quote me on this, she will say something like, the anti-Semitic comments were coming from undercover Trump supporters who snuck into Columbia University with their key cards and were doing that to make the college students look bad. Joe Biden said he had his fine people on both sides comment. He said, people don't understand what Palestine is going through, as if they're justified in what they're doing on these campuses. It's a mostly peaceful protest, supporting Hamas, saying, we are Hamas, pointing at those students holding Israeli flags, saying Hamas's next target. It's mostly peaceful. There's love. It's the summer of love. There's love on that campus. Wall Street Journal, who's behind the anti-Israel protests? It says Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and others are grooming activists in the United States and across the West. And they don't cover it as much in this article, but I suspect a lot of it comes from Qatar and Al Jazeera. They promote this anti-Israel narrative in the media. The journal says major terror organizations have expressed support for these protests and disruptive actions, of course, which have long been a key part of Hamas's plan to win hearts and minds in the West. Talks about how they've been running these social media campaigns for over a decade. And you want to talk about fake news, propaganda. I mean, they call it Pollywood for a reason. there is no place more fake than the left-wing media that reports on news in Israel. The journal says it is no coincidence that official statements by Hamas and major jihadist groups about the protests are nearly identical. I mean, going back to what we covered at the start, they coordinate this together. It's the regime media for a reason. The statements seem like talking points for pressuring U.S. and Western decision makers. They appear to be working. On April 4th, President Biden, under massive pressure for supporting Israel, warned Israel of major changes to U.S. policy if it didn't ease its military campaign in Gaza. Hamas seized on the U.S.-Israel dispute with a statement calling on all free people of the world to protest. Again, I think it's interesting how much Joe Biden uses TikTok as well. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Federal employees are banned from using TikTok. Joe Biden can't stop because he's got to reach the youth vote. But this one commentator that we'll play a clip for talks about the pro-Hamas stories on TikTok outnumber pro-Israeli stories 50-1. I mean, it's a propaganda tool, and Biden thinks this is where the young people are. We've got to appeal to the young people. The young people want Hamas. They're anti-Israel, and that's a facade. I mean, Biden's campaign, I think there are some people who, who run it that genuinely have no clue what they're doing. They're just DEI hires and they're in way over their head. And then there are those who are very calculated, very coordinated, know what they're doing, probably laughing at the DEI hires as they fumble this campaign, as they have Joe Biden campaign at a gas station where nobody will look at him. The Journal says 6 months after the attack on Israel, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis and others aren't merely cheering those protesting in the streets. They are working with and grooming activists in the United States and the West through meetings, online interviews, and podcasts. Haytham Abdo, a PFLP representative, highlighted this cooperation in a January 31st interview with Brian Becker, national coordinator of the Answer Coalition, a hard-left anti-war umbrella group. Mr. Abdo said, "This is the first time there has been such a massive demonstration of support in the U.S., claiming that more than 50% of young Americans are now pro-Palestinian. We see that the Biden or the American administration now is affected by this transformation in the U.S. people." This is that PFLP representative talking. The Journal says, on March 25th, the Columbia University Apartheid Divest Student Group hosted an event called Resistance 101 on campus. It featured leaders of the PFLP-affiliated Within Our Lifetime and other extremist organizations. At the event, former PFLP official, another name I can't say, referred to his friends and brothers in Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the PFLP in Gaza, saying that particularly after October 7th, this is happening on a college campus, when they see students organizing outside Palestine, they really feel that they are being backed as a resistance and they're being supported. On March 30th, on Hezbollah's Al-Manar TV, Mr. Barakat said, "The vast majority of young Americans and Canadians now support armed resistance because of the introduction of colonialism, racism, and slavery studies into history curricula." I mean, they know exactly what they're doing, exactly what they're teaching at these universities. Ilhan Omar knows exactly what her daughter is being taught at Columbia. She's not being taught to love the Founding Fathers. She's not being taught to adhere to and to admire and to uphold the U.S. Constitution. They know what they're being taught at Columbia. The Journal says, "The collaboration between senior terrorists and their growing list of friends in the United States and the West has real-world consequences." It's these NGOs, it's these dark donor groups that fund a lot of these social media campaigns. It's the same with these fact-checkers on Facebook, for instance. They say they have 30 fact-checkers that help Facebook. And all of them are funded by these dark money groups. And now we're learning that these dark money groups closely affiliated with terrorist organizations operating essentially in the United States. The Journal says these groups are designated terrorists for a reason. They don't plan marches and rallies, they carry out terrorist attacks. And when the U.S. and Western activists, including college students, see that their marches and protests aren't achieving their goals, they may consider their next steps, which will be influenced by the company they have been keeping. Arrogant and ignorant. They talk about targeting American students because they're so ignorant of world events. They're so ignorant of the reality of what's happening in the Middle East. Obama, he attended Columbia. He spent a lot of time with pro-Palestinian leaders. We've spoken about on this program before his good friend Rashid Khalidi. Khalidi, he's a big proponent of the one-state solution, which is Israel doesn't get a state. Israel and the Arabs are forced to share one nation, which of course would be ruled by a majority of Arabs. He once called conservative Jews who were getting positions in government, he said they are infesting American politics. This was someone that Barack Obama in Hyde Park on the south side of Chicago would have dinner with 3 to 4 times a week. along with Bill Ayers. That's covered in David Garrow's biography. Here's a clip. This is from a New York University professor. NYU, this is where the NPR CEO that we played clips of on Monday, she went to NYU. This is from a clip from a professor at that university talking about how serious this problem is, the double standard when it comes to anti-Semitic remarks on social media or in these protests. This is clip 15.
And I do think there is a double standard. I walked by NYU last night. What I saw was peaceful protest. But I can tell you, if I went into the NYU square with a white hood on and said, lynch the blacks or burn the gays, my ID would be shut off by that night. And I would never work in academia again. There would be no need for the words context or nuance. I wouldn't be protected by terms like First Amendment or free speech. I would be out of the world of academia. It seems like we have a double standard when it comes to hate speech, as long as it's against Jews.
Why is there that double standard? Because of course you're right. You don't even have to say it out loud. If these things were being said about black people or gay people or Latinos or Asian or anybody else, forget it. Shut down the school. Everybody's expelled. Why is there still that double standard?
I also think that incorrectly, students on campus conflate the civil rights movement with what is going on in Palestine and have digressed, unfortunately, because of an orthodoxy promoted by me and my colleagues that there are oppressors and oppressed. And the easiest way to identify oppressors is how white and how rich they are. Fairly or unfairly, Israel is seen as ground zero for whiteness and how wealthy they are. And then what might sound paranoid doesn't mean I'm wrong. I think we are being manipulated, specifically youth, who their frame for the world is TikTok. And if you look at TikTok, there are 52 videos that are pro-Hamas or pro-Palestinian for every one served on Israel. I think that we are being manipulated. I think Americans are easier to fool than convince they've been fooled. But if I were the CCP, I'd be doing exactly the same thing.
That bit about TikTok at the end there, 52 pro-Hamas stories, essentially, to every one pro-Israel. I mean, that platform is essentially CCP regulated, CCP curated news for the United States. Of course they're trying to sow division. Of course they're trying to tear apart the United States. A lot of young people say these social media platforms are their only source for news. And they're being fed a steady diet of anti-Americanism, anti-colonialism, anti-Semitism, and it's sowing division. Now, on the other hand, a lot of these countries like the UK or Australia, they're banning TikTok, and there's an argument for that. It's a hard, hard question to answer once you start censoring these platforms, because now they have the power to regulate speech. And just taking that away is probably not going to turn these Columbia students into very well informed and educated students on Israeli politics. I don't think banning TikTok is going to suddenly cause this awakening among these university educated people like Ilhan Omar's daughter. So they use this as an excuse to grab power. Now, if you are informed and you are educating yourself on the news, you're probably not relying on TikTok, probably reading more for yourself, studying what these events mean and what they're leading to. But look at some of these nations that are censoring. The United States, I think it was in the top of the news before we started the show about Joe Biden going to sign the bill to ban TikTok in the United States. And that is, it's CCP news. That's what it is. But once they can ban one, what stops them from going to the next? What stops them from banning Facebook and Twitter? I mean, they probably won't, because rather than being CCP controlled, they're run by Joe Obama. They want control, though, of that information. This story out of Australia. Australia's censored a lot of free speech over the years, but there is this incident where this Muslim broke into a church in Australia and stabbed this minister in front of everybody. And that led to a lot of protests, and now the Australian government wants that video removed because it's inciting violence. And they want Elon Musk to remove that video. And Musk said, I'm not going to take it down. That's what happened. Now, I think maybe it's censored in Australia, but Australia wants it to be removed throughout the whole world so nobody can see this Muslim stabbing a Christian. This is what the Prime Minister of Australia said about Elon Musk just a couple days ago, clip 10.
I want to ask you about Elon Musk. He's mocked you this morning for choosing censorship and propaganda over free speech and truth. What's your response to that?
Well, this is a bloke who's chosen ego and showing violence over common sense. I think that Australians will shake their head when they think that this billionaire is prepared to go to court fighting for the right to sow division and to show violent videos, which are very distressing. He is in social media, but he has a social responsibility in order to have that social license. And what has occurred here is that the eSafety Commissioner has made very sensible suggestions. Other social media companies have complied without complaint. But this bloke thinks he's above the Australian law, that he's above common decency. And I tell you what, I say to Elon Musk that he is so out of touch with what the Australian public want. This has been a distressing time. And I find this bloke on the other side of the world, from his billionaire's establishments, trying to lecture Australians about free speech. Well, I won't cop it, and Australians won't either. No one is above the law. Not Elon Musk, not any Australian citizen. When it comes to operating here in Australia, he has a business that gives him a lot of profit, and I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law and above common decency. This bloke thinks he's above everyone. Well, that's not the way that Australia operates. It shows how arrogant this bloke is. That's what it shows.
Sounds pretty similar to all of the state leaders during COVID. He's so arrogant. This is what the Australian people want. Is it really? Or are they protecting the fact that multiculturalism has failed and they're protecting their woke ideology? And now, well, what if they ban Twitter? Because Elon Musk isn't removing the content that we want. They want control, and it's starting in Australia, it's starting in Scotland, it's in England, it's in Ireland, and it's in a lot of states in America right now, and now it's going to start coming down from the federal level. These are not free nations anymore. They'll give you the illusion of freedom, or they used to at least. Then COVID came and they showed their true colors. But at any moment in these nations, you could find police, you could find FBI agents, federal agents at your doorstep because of something you posted online. And it's happening in the United States too. If you haven't yet read Mr. Palmer's article in the latest Trumpet magazine, it's called The Global War on Free Speech. Talks about the tiniest things that you could do on social media that could get you arrested. Not even liking a post, but saving it as even like a screenshot onto your phone. These governments, they want control, and they'll use any little crisis they can to get it. This is an article from Michael Schellenberger. He runs a Substack called The Public. He says, CIA recruit is pursuing global internet censorship as e-safety czar in Australia. It says, Twitter owner Elon Musk should be thrown in prison, said a senator in Australia yesterday, because he refuses to delete a video of a recent stabbing from Twitter globally. It says, whatever Elon Musk is on, said Senator Jackie Lambie, it's disgusting behavior. Quite frankly, the bloke should be jailed. I don't know how many times they've said bloke in these clips. Schellenberger says, but what's truly disgusting behavior is calling for the incarceration of someone for refusing to censor the entire global internet on behalf of a single nation. Schellenberger says, many of us, myself included, have long suspected that government censors in Ireland, Scotland, and the European Union would attempt to censor the whole of the internet, not just in their own countries. With Brazil and now Australia demanding the power to censor the whole internet, it's clear that our fears were more than justified. And they use their market. They have huge markets. The United States, if you're an advertiser, you're paying to show your ad to an audience that I think on Twitter would be, you know, tens of millions. If you're Facebook, you know, the United States market, it's not nearly as huge as the global market. And there are billions of people on Facebook. So Brazil has over 200 million. Australia, the UK, you combine the EU in there, that's 500 million. Now they can throw that weight around and say, well, if you don't censor them here, you're removed from exposure to our market and your advertisers can't promote their material here and you lose money. Schellenberger says, now we have learned that there's a formal government censorship network called the Global Online Safety Regulators Network, which Australia's top internet censor, Julie Inman Grant, who is an American, described at World Economic Forum. The group includes censors from Australia, France, Ireland, South Africa, Korea, the UK, and Fiji. Julie Inman Grant, she says this, yes, we do regulate the platforms. We have a big stick that we can use when we want to. They're going to be regulated in ways that they don't want to be regulated. And just Julie Inman Grant, they're trying to control the internet, and she's a big Obama fan. After Obama gave that speech at Stanford, she posted on Twitter, she said, fabulous speech by Barack Obama. There's no question that social media has polarized debate and weaponized human malfeasance, but there are effective safety by design methods for engineering out misuse and online harms regulators, like the office she runs, to serve as a backstop. I mean, they all want control. And Obama, like I said earlier, there's the dog whistle in that speech. Take more control to these other nations, to the Biden administration. Take more control and we'll decide what truth is. This is a clip from that Australian senator who was talking about Elon Musk being jailed because he's not doing what they want. This is clip 11.
So when it comes to the tech billionaire, like I've already said, I think he's a social media knob with no social conscience. He has absolutely no social conscience. Someone like that should be in jail and the key be thrown away. That bloke should not be have a right to be out there on his own ideology platform and creating hatred, you know, showing all this stuff out there to our kids and doing all the rest. I'm very interested to watch what the US is going to do with TikTok and how far that they can do with trying to get rid of that platform as well. So I think we're all watching on the United States at the moment to see what they're doing. But seriously, if we can move and if that means in the next sitting that we can shut him down from doing this, because this is...
You happy to kick them out?
Restful.
Kick the platform out?
I don't give a stuff about the platform. I'm happy to go off the platform today, to be honest with you. I already have a list of all you journalists. I don't even know why we're on the platform.
I mean, there she is, like, as if Elon Musk was a member of the Communist Party in China. Just because he won't censor what they want him to. I mean, they'll use this little mini crisis that they've made up to take an immense amount of power. What she said there, I'm interested to see how the TikTok ban goes. I mean, that tells you all you need to know pretty much about that ban, where they want it to go. And Donald Trump did introduce it, and there it's clearly a tool used by the Chinese Communist Party. But where does that stop once you start taking away a few of these websites? They don't want the public to have access to information. They want to curate everything that you see and hear and learn about them. And she's bold and just saying it outright. She doesn't care about what the average citizen thinks. She wants to control that information. Remember what Obama said at that Stanford address, clip 14.
It is a chance for all of us to fight for truth. Not absolute truth. Not a fixed truth, but to fight for what deep down we know is more true. Is right. It's a chance for us to do that, not just because we're afraid of what will happen if we don't, but because we're hopeful about what can happen if we do. You know, over the last couple of months, we've seen what it looks like when a society loses the ability to distinguish truth from fiction.
It's a chance for us to do that. That's what they see this moment as. It's a chance for us to take control. And then how arrogant he is to act like he can define truth from fiction. It's his truth. It's will worship. This is Mr. Gerald Fleury from the March 2024 Trumpet, the unknown future of artificial intelligence. He says, Barack Obama has worked for years to control the internet. He now wants to control artificial intelligence. This is a quote. He's quoting Obama from that Stanford speech. It says, without some standards, implications of this technology for our elections, for our legal system, for our democracy, for rules of evidence, for our entire social order are frightening and profound, he said. Mr. Fleury writes, the truth is he wants to control this power, not to protect people, but for his own political purposes. Mr. Fleury says, in his speech, Obama also praised Europe's regulatory system and emphasized the need for regulatory cooperation. Look at these nations getting together. Listen to that clip from that Australian senator. We want to see what our partners are going to do. How are they going to crush Elon Musk? How are they going to prevent videos that don't align with the regime narrative from getting out? Because the people have too much power now. We can't risk that. Mr. Fleury, in his speech, Obama praised Europe's regulatory system and emphasized the need for regulatory cooperation. He stated, it is a chance for all of us to fight for truth, not absolute truth, not a fixed truth, but to fight for what deep down we know is more true, is right. And that is what we're up against. It's lies. It's this fake world, and they want control over all of these websites. They want to muzzle anybody that would speak out against them. And they'll say it like, oh, it's just we're fighting to preserve unity. We're fighting for public safety. It's for your own good. Just give us the power and we will take care of you. You need America under attack. You need the information in this book to help you see through these lies. Well, Mr. Fleury is not kidding when he calls this the fastest hour in broadcasting. Maybe it's not for you, the listener, but definitely when you're speaking, that goes by very fast. I had a whole segment I wanted to get into about the Trump trial and explaining some of the details about the case that Alvin Bragg is bringing against him. Maybe I'll get into that tomorrow or on Friday, but I have quickly run out of time. Any comments for the show, again, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. If you want to request any literature that we promote on the show, that number is 1-866-930-3024. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again tomorrow.